Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Mod State Podcast. Just before we start this, if you have not listened to the part one of this two-part podcast episode, please go back and listen to it. Well, you can listen to this one if you want, but the first part of this podcast obviously began with the article with Will Hilton and Glenn Greenwald, so I will do none of the introduction for this one. We're basically going to jump back in to the podcast. So to recap just briefly, we've talked... this article has talked briefly about the difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and sort of the misappropriated outrage to Donald Trump in terms of what you might get if Hillary Clinton was president. Obviously, a lot of hypotheticals, but probably fairly factual. We also talked about Russian hacking and the influence in the election, and also the difference between a president like Donald Trump in the Oval Office in the most powerful nation in the world versus, and Glenn Greenwald uses as an example, the former Chilean dictator whose sphere of influence was fairly insular, unlike that of Donald Trump. So, moving on, this is back to Will Hilton and Glenn Greenwald. So Will asks, when you hear people like Jim Clapper and John Brennan all over the news these days, does this alarm about Trump and Russia have any credibility with you? Or has their credibility been so diminished that their analysis doesn't count for anything? So Glenn says, the latter. I'll tell you why. It doesn't mean that everything John Brennan or James Clapper says is inherently false or ill-motivated. But I do think that broadly speaking, there are two types of critiques of Trump. One is that his policies that he's implementing and the rhetoric that he's spouting are dangerous and wrong. And that's the kind of critique that I'm receptive to. I think there's another kind of critique of Trump that has generated a lot of the most vehement opposition among people like national security state officials and longtime Republican operatives, who were totally fine and happy with all those horrific abuses of Bush and Cheney, which at least to date far exceed the abuses of the Trump years. Trump basically rips the mask off the reality of what the United States government does in the world. He makes it harder to maintain the propaganda about what the U.S. is and what it does. He's a threat to the power structures that have long ruled Washington because he doesn't need them, and in fact is hostile to them. I think people like Brennan and Clapper and the like fall into the latter category. The idea that they're concerned about noble precepts of democracy or decency and morality in government, I think, is completely contrary to everything their entire lives have been about. This is a fairly interesting point that Glenn brings up. And I think that's something that we do look past as a layperson in the United States, that a lot of what Trump is doing is undermining American policy, foreign policy, et cetera, in our sort of status in the world, because we always have been able to sort of channel the narrative and drive the narrative that everything we're doing is somewhat in the context of pushing forth a democratic initiative or agenda. Again, I'm not trying to make the case against Russia or somehow lighten the load that the scandal that's going on with Russia in terms of their hacking in the United States election. We know it happens on both sides. What is more noble? What is more moral? Which one's more moral? I don't know. Well, I Team America, pushing forth democracy is probably better, but I'll be realistic when I say it's not always about democracy, and I think it would be kind of dumb or ignorant to think that. And I think it's true. I mean, I think whether we like the president or not, I think he is ripping apart sort of the precedent and the norms in Washington. But I also think, and maybe disagree with Glenn here a little bit, when I say that I think that there's a, 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 a large majority or a big portion of the argument that Brennan and Clapper are, the large part of their argument is because of sort of the degradation of places like the State Department and sort of the diplomacy that we have had throughout the world. So it's kind of an interesting argument and one to think about. Will goes on to say, or ask and say, it seems like one of your concerns about the way this story has been reported is not only about those bold-faced themes, but the preponderance of anonymous leaks from intelligence agencies. You are unwilling to assign credibility to leaks that come out of FBI, CIA, and NSA. Glenn says, I thought the lessons of the Iraq War was that we were no longer going to place blind faith in the evidence-free assertions of anonymous officials inside the government. It should have been the lesson from Vietnam War and from so many other significant events over previous decades. But at least I thought that was the lesson from the Iraq War. Will asks and says, certainly the Iraq War was an example of intelligence agencies misleading the public. On the other hand, the Watergate scandal broke because Bob Woodruff trusted an intelligence official, namely Mark Felt, deputy director of the FBI. So the next part of this, having a sip of espresso here. The next part of this interview goes back and forth about whether or not Bob Woodruff did actually talk to the deputy director of the FBI. So I'm going to skip this part and you can read it if you would like to. They're sort of just piecing together what the timeline of the Watergate scandal was. So we're going to move down here. And a lot of what they talk about is the 3 days after the burglary, with the reporting to the Washington Post was based entirely on anonymous sources. So Will says, what I'm saying is there's a long tradition in journalism of building a case slowly. You might begin with reliable anonymous sources and develop more concrete evidence over time. A lot of good stories begin that way, including Watergate specifically. And Glenn says, I just don't see it that way. But more importantly, I don't think it's become a valid story unless there was evidence for it. Will then moves along to ask, well, let me ask you about Michael Cohen's plea deal. The president is now an unindicted co-conspirator in a federal felony, and it's one that pertains to the election in an effort to hide information from the public that influenced votes. If the Democrats win the House this fall, would they be justified in pushing for impeachment? Glenn says, I think it would be the height of all ironies if a Democratic House decided to bring impeachment charges against the president based on claims that he sought to conceal evidence of an extramarital affair. Will says, so the motive for this, to influence the outcome of an election, doesn't differentiate it from the motive behind Bill Clinton lying about Monica Lewinsky? Glenn replies, he was lying about Monica Lewinsky because he was afraid of political injury, of being politically crippled by revelations that he abused his power in order to have consensual, in quotes, sex with a 22-year-old intern inside the Oval Office, and he perjured himself, which is a crime. But I never thought that's the sort of thing that rose to the level of removing a president, even though it was clearly wrong. Before you reverse the outcome of an election or nullify it, I think that it should take some very serious crimes. I don't think paying off porn stars to remain silent rises to the level where I would feel comfortable impeaching a president. So, interesting in the terms of what becomes impeachable. And John and I have talked about this on the podcast before. And, you know, impeaching a president, regardless of the crime, I mean, if it's a serious crime, high crimes, misdemeanors, if it's something truly heinous, I think it warrants it. Good example would be in Seoul, South Korea, or rather just South Korea, where they recently impeached their president for basically bribery. And she wound up getting something crazy like 28 years in prison or something like that. And it was beyond just a simple bribe. It was from the sort of oligarchy there and the conglomerates of big business there that millions and millions of dollars were shuffled around. So it wasn't just a bribe for a sanitation company or something like that. So, before we get into that a bit more, from the article, Will says, what's your sense of how likely it will happen? Glenn says, well, there's going to be a lot of Democrats who are going to be representing districts that voted for Donald Trump, and in 2 years, they're going to face re-election. So I don't believe there are going to be enough Democrats in the House willing to impeach Trump. I also think that there's going to be a political calculation just like in 2006, when they promised they were going to end the Iraq War and took over the House based on that promise. And then they decided that they actually didn't want to end the Iraq War because they wanted to run against it in 2008. I think they would love to run against Trump in 2020 as opposed to Pence. So I think there's going to be political calculation. Let's just cripple Trump, but let him kind of stumble to the finish line. Obviously, I could be wrong about this. There could be much graver revelations of wrongdoing. And then also you need 2/3 in the Senate to convict him and remove him. So this comes down to, there's sort of two sides of the House now. If you were to go, and not the House in the Capitol, but in the United States, preferably. So if you were to go to a place like Huffington Post, where I actually found this article, there's a whatever segment of the population that reads that and comments on a lot of those articles would like to see the president impeached, would like to see him in an orange jumpsuit, and would like to see him in handcuffs and marched off to Leavenworth. And there's a lot of people that feel that that's justified. Now, you have to start asking the questions. What is justified? And just because we don't like somebody doesn't mean that maybe we should put the world into chaos or the United States into chaos for an impeachment for someone we just don't like. And that's just the case here. And in terms of the article here, I think that Glenn Greenwald brings up a good point. He said there could be graver revelations of wrongdoing, and I think there's a lot of people in the United States that are popping popcorn and hoping for this ending to the movie. I personally don't think we will see something like that, and even if we did, I certainly don't see impeachment. And I don't, as much as I don't like the president and what he's doing, I don't know that impeachment is the best thing for the country or for that sort of institution. If we could let him, as it's said here, and maybe a democratic sort of strategy to let him stumble to the finish line, maybe that would be better to do what the Republicans did in the latter part of President Obama's legacy, or rather presidency, was just sort of stifle anything that we could move forward. And you have to ask yourself that question. Pending that there is no graver revelation of wrongdoing, then what would you like to do? Expend our energy, the time that we should be, let's say the Democrats take back the House and the Senate. Should there be a focus on policies that will affect people in the United States in a way that you would like to see, or should the energy be to impeach a president? Which one? Sort of your choice. Will goes on to say, yeah, conviction clearly isn't on the menu at this point, but impeachment may be. Talk to me about the positioning of the Democratic Party. You mentioned people being elected from Trump's country, but we also have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez coming in, sort of the new left. Do you think they will just be a form of a caucus within a party, or do you think they can shift the party overall? Now, if you listen back to the original podcast, I talk a little bit about Democratic messaging in relation to this article, and this is kind of an interesting part of the podcast. Excuse me, the article, not the podcast. Glenn says, it's hard to say. I think there's going to be a massive war over exactly that. I think the Democrats are likely to do well in the midterm elections, and that's going to help Democrats mask a lot of problems we were talking about earlier. But over time, I don't think the Democratic Party can sustain in its current formulation as this corporate-friendly, corporate-funded, corporate-branded party. If you look at Western democracies, exactly those kind of parties are disappearing, like the Blairites in the UK and the Socialists in France, in favor of those harder, more ideological factions within what has been the broad left. And I think that's going to happen in the US. It'll probably take longer, but I don't think that's where the trend is headed. Excuse me, he says, I do think that's where the trend is headed. So, again, this is me now. It's interesting. This is exactly what, you know, John and I have been talking about, and what I truly believe, that the Democratic Party itself has sort of lost its way, and that's exactly what it is. It's corporate-funded, it's Wall Street, it's corporate-friendly, and that's no different from the Republican Party, folks. If you're a Democrat, I mean, God bless you if you're jumping on the bandwagon for the blue-collar worker or the middle class in this country and for those in poverty as well. But the true Democratic Party, as much as they paint this photo, this picture of of working for the common man, I mean, I think both sides do to some degree espouse this, that's not the case. And it might not be the Democratic Party that does it, but it might be these factions within the Democratic Party. If you remember back to the Tea Party, that was, or the Freedom Caucus, that is a caucus within the Republican Party or the conservative sort of ideology. So we might see this happen. So this might be the way it does, the way this happens, as opposed to just the Democrats re-messaging, or as Glenn Greenwald says in this article, masks the current problem if you just get a superstar type of candidate. Will goes on to say, I wonder how that connects to the Russian story. We see people like Cortez and Ilhan Omar coming to the party with all this new energy, but at the same time, you have Adam Schiff getting love from Russia, for the Russia investigation, from people who probably don't know very much about his record on surveillance and national security. How do you reconcile your hope that the party is evolving in a certain way with your fear that the party is willing to reward anyone who opposes Trump? So this is something, and before I get into Glenn Greenwald's answer to this question, this is true. I mean, you may be able to run in 2020 and 2018 on opposing Trump, but how far does that go? And when Trump is running in 2020, or if he's not, I don't know, but beyond 2020, what's your plan? And for as much love I seem to be not giving the Democratic Party, I'm centrist left, and I do want to see the messaging change. And it's just suggestion to say that there needs to be a long-term plan, and people will see through the bullshit after a while that you're running on the same platform that effectively Republicans are, bar a little bit of fiscal policy. So Glenn Greenwald says in response to this, my principal concern over this maniacal obsession with Russia is that it's elevating not just voices, but a mentality and worldview that I think is harmful and also not politically viable. There's a huge number of people who are paying a lot closer attention to politics for the first time because of their fear of Trump and are being inculcated with the views of jingoism and militarism, so fake news, etc. That's very much the ethos of this attack on Trump from the Russian perspective. He's a traitor. He's committing treason. I mean, they all sound like Willem Buckley or J. Edgar Hoover. They're reading from that script and affirming those values. You don't meet with foreign bad leaders. You have to show strength, which means never cooperating. Reagan was accused of being a useful idiot by the far right when he would meet with Gorbachev. This is the same kind of language and the same kind of mentality. I realize there are some differences because of concerns that Trump is beholden to the Russians, but the people who are leading this charge are very militaristic and very imperialistic, and do not have a long history of being pro-war like Adam Schiff, like obviously the neocons who have been rehabilitated, like the leaders of the security state. And I see this becoming even more than it was before, the defining force of the Democratic Party. I think it's extremely harmful, and I think it's postponing politically this rejuvenation that's needed if Democrats are going to compete for this long term as an alternative party to far-right movements that are succeeding all over the world. This isn't me now. There's a interesting book that is called Positive Populism, and I'll put a link to the show notes. Because again, I'm failing on the author, but he does a show on Fox News at 9 Eastern on Sunday nights. And it's an interesting look into populism, because populism is this inherently negative thing that we see today. And negative in a lot of parts of the world, like Italy and Hungary and stuff like that, or places like that. So that's the good point. I mean, this is the point he's saying, listen, anti-Trump is not the defining platform for the Democratic Party. It is not. I mean, the Republicans, in a way, don't have anything to lose here. Even by aligning with Trump, there's enough people that will back them, I suppose, unless Democrats really come out in droves. But at the end of the day, what is your foundation? What is the bedrock by which you want to build your party up? And if you can't do it, people like Cortez are going to do it. Bernie Sanders is going to do it, because if you lose the common man, if you, as you are in the Democratic Party, then you lose that power, or could. Will goes on to say, but it's not just Clapper and Brennan and Schiff. It's also the Obama podcast bros, who came out of an administration that was not possessed of this impulse towards Russia. They're big into Russiagate now, or a genuine progressive intellect like Rachel Maddow, who is not spending very much airtime on income inequality and police brutality and public education, the issues you might imagine at this moment when Ocasio-Cortez is ascendant. Rather, she's exploring the granular developments of the Russia probe night after night. So Glenn says, exactly. And I mean, leaving aside the substantive disagreement that we explored earlier, just look at the things politically. During the Cold War, the reason the Soviets were so effective, scary villains, is because Americans were told that they were godless and highly repressive. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda worked because they were Muslim and very menacing and foreign, but also because they actually flew planes into two huge skyscrapers and caused them to come tumbling down in the middle of New York. So not much work was required to convince people that they were actually a threat to the American way of life. I really just don't think that many Americans who don't watch Rachel Maddow are waking up in the morning with Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin anywhere near the top of their list of concerns. The Democratic Party leaders, the main media representatives, and the national messaging are all focused on an issue that I don't think people care much about and don't perceive will make their lives better. So I think just by the onslaught of mainstream media and the coverage of Donald Trump, I think we do wake up and we do think about it. But in terms of the Maslow hierarchy of needs, the food, water, shelter, sex, etc., it is not the first thing we're thinking about, and most people can't be really bothered with. Again, everything I've been talking about in terms of Democratic messaging. Is it a thing? Is it something that we should absolutely be concerned about? Yes, and we will. As I do, I sit back and I say, let Mueller do his investigation. And it's not up to me at this point to make assumptions about what's happening, because really I could be focusing my energy in other places. And I think we could do that as well. Will goes on to say, certainly airtime is zero sum. Every hour you spend in Russia, you're not spending on other things. But someone like Maddow might say, Russia is the mechanism by which we challenge this president so that we can advance our priorities. I mean, I don't want to ventriloquize for her, but I would imagine there are some people who feel like the focus on Russia is what most likely to get Trump out of power and stop putting children in cages. Glenn says, I think you're right, but I don't think if you're a journalist, your obligation is to devote yourself to whatever... Excuse me, he says, if you're a journalist, your obligation is to devote yourself to whatever is the most politically effective argument. I spent my time for a long time in surveillance, which is an issue that I didn't think was very politically significant, but I thought it was the most important substantively. So if she were to say, like, hey, I'm spending my time on this, not because I think that people care about it, but because I think it's the biggest and most important story, then I think that's totally valid, because her job isn't to win. That's the Democratic Party's job. But I think what you said is her reason. Even though she's a journalist, I think she's also anti-Trump and an activist. Will says, I don't accept that journalists shouldn't be political. It's fine for some journalists to have a political agenda. Glenn says, yeah, I'm totally fine if it's their goal. I have my own political goals, and you know I'm very open about it. But I don't understand the line of reasoning that Russia is the most effective way to get rid of Trump. What's the mechanism to get rid of him that way? You and I have talked about the extreme unlikelihood that he would actually be convicted in the Senate. Extreme unlikelihood may be overstating the likelihood. Glenn says, okay, well, a very, very highly unlikely unlikelihood. They move on to talk about a little bit more. Will then asks him, do you have any misgivings about spending so much time on Fox? And this is venturing into Glenn Greenwald's sort of future endeavors and currently what he's doing within his journalism career. Do you have any misgivings about spending so much time on Fox? Glenn says no. And I'm not just saying that because I'm inventing some justification. When I first started blogging back in 2005 or 2006, my primary audience were liberals because I was mostly criticizing Bush and Cheney. But because I was writing about executive power and the imperial presidency, the Cato Institute started taking an interest in my work and they invited me to come speak. A lot of liberals were confused and angry and indignant. Like, how can you go and speak before the Cato Institute? I wrote something about how if you believe in the things you're saying and you think what you have to say is important, you're necessarily going to maximize your audience and seek out people who have different ideologies than you and try and persuade them to think differently about the issues. I probably wouldn't go on Stormfront Radio, like actual Nazi Party channels. And no, I don't think Fox is the equivalent of the Nazi Party. And then Will goes on to ask, well, Tucker Carlson gets close to it. Did you see his thing on South Africa land reform and white farmers being under siege? Those are white nationalist tropes. Glenn says, yeah, they definitely get close to white nationalist tropes. I mean, the whole immigration thing is intertwined with white nationalism, but I think we ought to reserve Nazism for people advocating genocide. Anyway, my view has always been that you should judge people by what they say and not where they say it. I don't have a moral obligation to stay off TV if Wolf Blitzer and Rachel Maddow aren't investigating me on their shows. Will says, has it been frustrating to spend so much time writing about this media narrative on Russia? You said the role of a journalist is to go after the people who wield the greatest power. There must be days when you'd rather be studying leaked EPA files and hold administration feet to the fire instead of fact-checking the media. Glenn says, well, two things about that. One is that I did start doing a lot of reporting in the last year and a half about industrial agricultural and factory farms and the revolving door at the agricultural department. It always has been the case, but it's way worse under Trump, that people who are completely invested in the agriculture industry are responsible for implementing the minimal regulations on the treatment of animals in our food supply and environment. So I do want to be doing that. But having said that, it's not just the media, the blob, the deep state, the military-industrial complex, whatever you want to call them. I think that it's a really powerful faction, and I think that they are really at war with Trump. And a lot of what they're doing is really damaging. But yeah, I do wish that we'd be focusing more on stuff Trump is really doing as opposed to these Tom Clancy espionage thriller fantasies. Will then asks, do you think that the reporting on financial corruption in the Trump organization has been more substantial than the reporting on election interference? Glenn says, oh, infinitely. To the extent that I think there's a real Russian scandal, I've always felt like that's where it lies. There's this new axis of power, this kind of emerging alliance between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, Israel, Russia, and Trump, and the alt-right movement generally. There are a lot of stories that I find really interesting. There are stories that I find really interesting about Emiratis and Saudis buying apartments in Trump buildings for way above market price. I'm sure Trump is financially linked to Russian organized crime and Russian banks in all kind of dirty ways that involve money laundering and tax evasion. That stuff, I think, is 100% real and genuinely urgent and pressing. So that's the end of that. That was the end of that article. And obviously, this has been a two-part podcast series. But, you know, in sort of conclusion of this entire thing, and that entire article jumped around quite a bit and touched on a lot of different things. I believe it was from a 7-hour phone conversation and interview rather. And I think, again, the conclusion and what I had said in the first part of this podcast, rather the other episode that I did on this, is that I think we need, whether that article interview was self-indulgent on Glenn Greenwald's part, whether there were some things that you agreed with or didn't, I think it's important as a listener, as a citizen of the United States and this globe, is to just take a moment to not be so insular, to not be so narrowed in your opinion about something. And that isn't to say that, again, you shouldn't be principled about certain things. You can be. But it's important to look beyond just the issue that you believe in. You have to look 2 steps, 3 steps outside of that. And the importance of that, not only is it because you can develop a better argument if you truly believe that, but you might find some things that you didn't quite understand about the issue that you believe so strongly in. And it can become difficult to take. I mean, I've been good word, lampooned by people close to me who wish I be more principled. And I have my values, I have my principles, I have my own constitution, but it doesn't have to do necessarily with political policy. It doesn't have to do with the flavor of the week. It is far better for me to formulate my values and my own convictions based on a macro viewpoint, based on taking a step back and developing facts. And I'm not always right. That's not the point, but I'm also willing to accept when I'm not right either, or when I'm wrong, and checking my emotional intelligence and making sure that I'm not jumping to some conclusion. And look, I think this is a pretty bad president. 100%. I do. And in terms of the diplomacy that other presidents have had, I'm not taking away the fact that we had a pretty crazy war in Iraq, and I took care of a lot of soldiers who were blown to bits from that war. And it's sad. But yeah, I think that when in terms of diplomacy and the standing in this world, I think that we have a subpar president in terms of articulation and his ability to make argument. But I also can step back and wonder and hypothesize and make inferences as to why we are here today. And it allows me to put aside the ability for me to quickly be tribal and to quickly take a side and accept the fact that someone who has a differing viewpoint, who might agree with the president about something, is somehow a racist xenophobe and someone that is an overzealous or religious zealot, that I just categorize them as this list of things because they believe a certain way. And I think a lot of people out there, folks, aren't just beholden to the two-party system. That I'm a Democrat no matter what, I'm Republican no matter what. I think when you actually press people on the issues, you find that you have far more in agreement than not. And that's the ability, that's you can do that with a macro perspective, with being centrist. So I might get a lot of hate for these two podcasts, and maybe the hate will just be the undeniable ramblings and weird format. Again, I give all credit to Will Hilton and Glenn Greenwald for that article. And of course, we'll post it for you to read in its entirety. But it's refreshing to read, whether you agree or not, sort of this step back approach to what's going on and what the difference is between a Hillary Clinton presidency and a Trump presidency is, or what all the grumblings are about with the Russian investigation and what position should we really take on this? Well, God bless you. If you want to see this the way the president goes down, if you want this to be the way the president goes down, that you think that there's way more there, well, I'm resigned to the fact that Robert Mueller's pretty damn good at what he does. And I'm going to let him do his work. Just like I'm not going to tell the surgeon how to do his job when he's fixing my knee. So it's not my job to be an investigative journalist. I didn't choose that as my profession. Will I follow the investigation? Absolutely. Will we do an episode about it? Absolutely. But it doesn't change the fact that there's things that are happening in the United States right now and in the world, things that need to be addressed and viewpoints that need to be unpacked. And as long as we need to do that, I'll continue to come here and I'll continue to be an informed citizen. So again, if you want to make the biggest difference, sign up to vote in November. Go do that. That's how you're going to make the difference. With that, we'll see you.